This morning we're going to begin by discussing the text of chapter 4 and verse 10, one specific statement that is made there. He says, "You observe days and months and seasons and years, and I am afraid for you, lest I have labored for you in vain." We're going to basically engage in a practical demonstration of what it is that we've been discussing on Wednesday evenings for the past several weeks. We've been discussing alleged Bible error, the perception that some have that the Bible has either some factual error contained in it or is self-contradictory. And of course, the claim that we make that the Bible is inspired would preclude the Bible being self-contradictory. In other words, the Bible not agreeing with itself. One of the principles that we follow as we study God's Word is that we can and therefore should look for a way or a means of reconciling passages that at first glance may seem to be contradictory. And so sometimes it's somewhat of a challenge. And in fact, in this particular passage that we're looking at here in chapter 4 and verse 10, where we're going to engage in this particular exercise, we have it under, in the handout, under difficult passages. That's the reason it's a difficult passage, because you look at it, and there seems to be the condemnation of the observance of days, whereas in Romans, the 14th chapter, it seems that the observance of days is something that is acceptable to God. And so the perception may be, or at least it's a difficulty that must be dealt with, is how do we reconcile those two passages of Scripture? So again, we'll note the passage there in Galatians chapter 4. And you may want to get your New Testaments, put a thumb between the pages there at Romans 14 as well, because we're going to look at that passage very quickly. And when we talk about difficult passages, that's typically what we're going to be looking at with regard to these, or at least a typical reason why we would consider it to be a difficult passage, because it, surface reading, initial reading, it seems to teach something that is slightly different than or directly contradictory to some other passage that you're familiar with. And we have done a lot of study of Romans, the 14th chapter. In Romans 14, you'll notice in verse 5, Romans 14 and verse 5, the statement that one person esteems one day above another, and another esteems every day alike. Let each be fully convinced in his own mind. Now, with regard to the subject, or the text of Romans 14, it has been an issue in recent decades because of differences that brethren have had with regard to the nature and extent of fellowship, who it is that we can have fellowship with, who it is that we cannot have fellowship with. And Romans 14 is a part of that discussion, because in verse 1 of that chapter we are told to receive one who is weak in the faith, but not to disputes over doubtful things. And the two scenarios that are mentioned in Romans 14 is the eating of meat and the observance of days. If you look at that text, what becomes clear in looking at the text is that the Apostle Paul is revealing there's nothing wrong with eating meat. And there is nothing wrong with observing or esteeming one day above another. In verse 5, again, notice this. One person esteems one day above another. Another esteems every day alike. And the instruction the Apostle Paul gives is let each be fully convinced in his own mind. So the only reason why the Apostle Paul would object to an individual esteeming one day above another is if an individual who did so was not conscientious in his action. That is, he has doubts about what he's doing. Later in the chapter, we are told that an individual is condemned if he doubts as he participates in these actions. And the reason for that is that we are called to heed fully our conscience. Now, if we think something to be wrong and we engage in that activity, and we, of course, use the phrase to be wrong, we have reference to how God perceives it. So we think something is condemned by God, something that God would not be accepting of, and we engage in that activity anyway, then we are sinning. It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant as to whether God actually is antagonistic toward that action. We think that he is. We do it anyway. We are actively rebelling against what we perceive to be his will, and that in and of itself is sinful. So that's why we are always to be fully convinced in our own mind that what we are doing is acceptable or right. But if you look at the context of Romans 14, what you find is an individual who is esteeming one day above another, who is fully convinced in his own mind in that regard. And as verse 3 indicates with the other scenario, we know that God has received him. In verse 4, God is able to make him stand. Verse 6, he is observing it to the Lord. So an individual who's doing that, everything in the context indicates that that's acceptable. There's nothing wrong for an individual to esteem one day above another. But then we go over to Galatians in the 4th chapter. And in verse 10 of the text, he indicates his fear for them. And of course, when we look at context, we're talking about fear for their spiritual well-being. As Ron mentioned a couple of weeks ago in a conversation I had with him, and I think it's a good point, is that the apostle's letter to the Galatians is a very abrupt epistle. There is little that he says with regard to the niceties of a salutation or ending. He simply tells them early on that what they're doing is sinful. What they're doing is something that will cause them to lose their souls, cause one who proclaimed what they were doing and acting as worthy of a curse, as found in Galatians chapter 1, 6 through 9. So there are very strong admonitions that are given upon their practices. And so the expression here, he says, "I fear for you," there in verse 10 of the text, or verse 11, "I am afraid for you, lest I have labored for you in vain," is an indication of a fear for their spiritual welfare. So look at the two contexts, and of course, the way in which these can be reconciled is by delving deeper into the context. When you look at this contextually, in Galatians 4 and verse 10, the observance of days, months, seasons, and years is something that brings an admonition, an expression of fear, of condemnation as a result of that practice. Whereas in Romans the 14th chapter, there is an indication that the esteeming of one day above another is something that is accepted by God. So there is a perceived, and it is only perceived, but a perceived contradiction between those two passages. And so what we want to do is reconcile those two passages in our lesson this morning. Of course, we have other things that we'll get into if we finish that particular part of our discussion. So does anyone at all desire to speak out and to begin the discussion or give their estimation as to how the two could be reconciled? That's our effort, to reconcile the two passages where they're fully understood. Not saying that it's necessarily difficult to do so, but it's necessary that we do so. So y'all just want me to start talking? Or?
I guess you're going to cover the nature of these observances.
Well, that's the first question I think that we need to raise. What's under consideration in Romans 14 and in Galatians chapter 4? Are they the same thing by nature?
I got a feeling it's about things like birthdays and Labor Day, I think, because Romans 14 is talking about observing to the Lord, those are sort of civil or secular sort of things that don't matter much.
Okay.
Religious context. But there is something to it. Somehow they're observing things that may be offensive to the Lord in that case.
Okay. Alright, so that's the first point, and perhaps we can be in agreement with regard to this, that in both contexts, Galatians 4 and Romans 14, the idea is a religious or a spiritual observance, not something that is secular.
You could say one problem here was that these Judaizer teachers wanted to keep the Christians there to observing the old days of observing the law of Moses. just making it a requirement on Romans 14 is people that are just, they're conscious. Because they used to not be able to eat the meat. They just, in all good conscience, couldn't eat it.
Okay.
There's nothing wrong with eating meat within itself.
Right. Nothing intrinsically wrong with that. Jerry has touched upon one of I think, the key aspects of this. When we look at the context of Galatians 4, as we've already discussed with a great deal of thoroughness, the passage or the epistle was written because individuals were binding the observance of the old law. And so the days that are under consideration in Galatians chapter 4 are those days that surround the Jewish faith and worship. So we talk about the Passover or Pentecost and those types of feasts, those special days, those seasons, those years that had a spiritual significance, and that under the old law there was a requirement that was given with regard to that observation. So the first point that we want to make in attempting to reconcile these passages, again, you may think I'm making this overly difficult, and I want to kind of go step by step through the process, so it's not necessarily a difficult thing, but I want to get to the reasoning. Understand, first of all, that what the Apostle Paul is dealing with here are the Judaizing teachers and those who have been impacted by that teaching, which required justification based upon an adherence to the old law. That's the emphasis that the entire book has, that it was destructive to them because there is no provision for mercy under that old law. Law-keeping could not save an individual, but those who were seeking to gain their standing with God based upon their adherence to that old law, then they were basically giving up grace, giving up that provision of mercy. And that provision of mercy that was granted when God sent His Son is the only means by which an individual can be saved. So that's why the Apostle Paul said, if we are an angel from heaven, preach any other gospel than that which is preached, let him be accursed. This is a serious thing. So the problem was the binding of these practices, that they were binding them. They were saying that these things are necessary as expressions of worship to God. That these things were the basis for their standing and their relationship with God, the keeping of the law. This is one of the symptoms, if you will. And again, we only can look through the lens of the text itself and see what Paul reveals about what was being practiced in the churches of Galatia. But just think about this. Paul had come in and he had preached Christ. There were, as a part of the churches of Galatia, the inclusion of Gentile converts. And now he becomes aware of the fact that the churches of Galatia were requiring individuals to keep the Jewish feast days or to observe those days, seasons, and years that were to be observed under the Jewish dispensation or the Old Covenant. So he looks and he sees that practice. And this is something that causes him concern. Now, the concern, or the actual practice of these things, is symptomatic of the problem. And the problem was that they were embracing the Old Covenant as a basis for their standing with God, just like the Jew did. And though they were now converts to Christ, they were going back to the beggarly elements, those things that they did not have the power to say. And so the observance of days were a symptom of that. So the Apostle Paul said, when I see you observing these days and these seasons and years, I'm afraid for you. Well, he's afraid because he understands that appealing to those things and to practice those things as a basis of your standing before God doesn't bring the hope of heaven, because that comes under the new, not the old. So that's the basis of his objection. So now what we have to do is differentiate between that and what was going on in Romans 14. So what's going on in Romans 14 with regard to this being one day above another? A couple of things that I want to point out. And there are things that we somewhat struggle with. Do you remember that that the Apostle Paul, as a Christian, and by the way, the Apostle Paul was the one that wrote both the Epistle to the Galatians as well as the Epistle to the Romans. Do you remember why it was that the Apostle Paul was initially taken prisoner, which led to his journey to Rome and his imprisonment in Rome? Anybody remember what caused that?
He'd
gone into the temple, and what had he done with those other men? You remember?
He was accused of taking one that was not circumcised.
But what was his purpose? Why was he in the temple in the first place? What was he doing?
Teach.
But he had taken a vow. Remember the vow that he had taken, which was a Nazarite vow. So he had taken that vow with several others, following the advice of several of the men in the church in Jerusalem. And it was an attempt to do what? It was an attempt to appease those Jews. Here, the Apostle Paul was Jewish, and he was observing a... Now, let's ask this question. It didn't work out well. We understand it didn't work out well, although God used it for his purpose. And the provision was made for Paul to go to Rome and to preach as part of his arrest and such. Did Paul sin by observing that vow? Was he contradicting what he wrote to the Galatians here in Galatians chapter 4? That's a tough question, isn't it?
I was going to say, I always wondered about
it. Yeah, it's something you wonder about. To be honest, I don't think that he did. I really do not. And I think that this is a distinction that we... And I acknowledge that this is a difficult thing, but understand this, that if an individual continues to observe certain practices that are legitimately cultural, then there's not necessarily a contradiction. And the reason, the rationale is why I think that the Apostle Paul did no wrong when he did what he did. Number one, he understood, just like the eating of meats, Apostle Paul understood that Nazarite vow had absolutely no bearing upon his standing with God. I don't think that his intent was in any way to do it as a religious observance, but rather as a national Jew. What he was doing was an effort to accommodate. To the Jew, I became a Jew. To the Greek, I became a Greek, that I may become all things to all men, that I might by some means win some. Let's make another parallel with regard to circumcision. He allowed Timothy to be circumcised. He expressed why it was he allowed Timothy to be circumcised, because there were certain Jewish Christians that knew that Timothy's mother was Jewish. And as a result of that, he allowed Timothy to be circumcised, whereas Titus he would not allow to be circumcised because Titus was Gentile. He was making a point with regard to Titus. Timothy didn't need to be circumcised. It had absolutely no bearing upon his standing with God, no impact at all. But it's something because he was a Jew, a national Jew. It was something as a part of their national culture and their existence as a people that could be allowed. But the Apostle Paul knew there was absolutely no religious significance to that. And so it was not something that could be bound. It was something that was an option, in other words. Okay? So I think that what my view of the events which led to Paul's arrest in the book of Acts is that what he was doing, again, it didn't work with regard to the efforts to appease the Jew, but he was doing nothing wrong in what he did because of his understanding. Just like the man who can eat meat, he understands that meat that is offered up to idols, that an idol is nothing. And so you buy meat offered to idols in the market, and you eat that you're not in any way observing anything religious. To him, it was simply a part of the culture, a part of the national practice, and he was doing it to appease other men. And so he was seeking to accommodate for the purpose of winning souls to Christ. Now, what I understand with regard to Romans chapter 14 and the observance of the day in Romans 14:5 is something that is understood and recognized as optional. Now, we talk about this with regard to the epistle, or 14th chapter. These things are matters of authorized liberty. They are matters of indifference to God. And that's something that is indicated in the very passage in verse 5. One esteems one day above another, another esteems every day alike. And what the Apostle Paul there is doing is making no differentiation between the two. It doesn't matter if you do, doesn't matter if you don't. It's an optional thing. It's something you can do. It's not something that's required. So here we find one fundamental difference between what was happening in Galatians 4 and what is happening in Romans chapter 14. Whatever these observances were, in Galatians 4, it was being touted as the basis for our standing with God. And in Romans chapter 14, what was being done was something that was acknowledged and understood as having absolutely no bearing with our standing with God. So the optional and individual nature of Romans 14 is different than the concept of requirement and justification by such actions in Galatians chapter 4. Now, above and beyond that, I have a hard time distinguishing with regard to the nature of the dates. So let me think as an example that if I am a Jew, I have to keep the Passover in order to be acceptable to God. If I am a Jew, I make a decision that I'm going to, individually, I'm going to take the Nazarite vow. I understand I don't have to take the Nazarite vow. Or I'm going to be circumcised. I understand I don't have to be circumcised, but it's part of my culture. And as a result of that, I'm going to do that, not binding it upon anyone else. I'm not requiring that of anyone else, but it's something that I practice privately. And that's the distinction that I see. So let's just make a practical application of that with regard to what just happened a few days ago with regard to the observance of Christmas. Now, we have long taught, and rightly taught, that it's wrong to observe Christmas as the religious world observes Christmas. It is a Catholic holiday that has been embraced by the majority of religious people that has its roots in pagan history. And that's something that we ought not to have anything to do with regard to the religious observance of Christmas. So when a religious group says, we have authority from God to set aside this specific date, we're going to come together and we're going to have a worship service that is centered on this particular thing, then what that is will worship. It's something that is not authorized by God. Matthew 15, Matthew chapter 7, all of the passages that we talk about, 2 Timothy chapter 3, with regard to God having supplied us with all things that are needful in order to be acceptable to God. Those things all apply. And it is, again, will worship when individuals erect traditions of men as a means of worshiping God. Just a practice that is very, very common. People don't blink twice about that, taking Christ out of Christmas. It's something people are upset about. Well, Christ neither authorized for the church to observe in any way a memorial of his birth. And so we don't do that. Now, having said that, is it wrong for me as an individual to set aside a day where I think about, contemplate, meditate upon, pray about, rejoice in the birth of Jesus? Absolutely not. It doesn't have to be December 25th, but it could be. It could be any day for me to do that and decide to do that. Is it necessary that I esteem a particular day, that I choose a particular day for such an observance? Well, it's nothing wrong with it, but it's not required. It's something I can do, but it's something I don't have to do. And so that's what's under consideration. And I think that you have to understand in Romans 14 the background from some individuals, and it may be that background was present with regard to the Gentiles. It could be that was remembered with regard to the Jews. And, a commemoration, a cultural commemoration, for example, of Passover, where an individual recognizes and is thankful for the provision that God showed to the Israelites, especially if you are a Jew, with regard to that, there would be nothing wrong with it. But to bind that and to observe that as a religious ritual that gives you standing with God is something entirely different. To say that we must do this as a nation, this is required of us, this is part of our covenant with God, is one thing. But to sit and contemplate and to think about and to esteem a particular day as an individual is something that is far different. So that's, as I understand it, the distinction that is made. What was being done in Galatians chapter 4 was being bound as necessary and required, and not only to the Jew, but also to the Gentile. What's being done in Romans chapter 14 is a personal scruple, where an individual says, this is something that I want to do for my Lord. And you have the right if you desire to do that. If you want to have a day where you fast, then you certainly have the right. You have to bind that upon me. If you say that the first Sunday of every single month, I'm going to fast from dawn to dusk, and I'm going to spend that time in worship with God, and I'm going to spend that time on Sunday afternoon in contemplation, meditation on the things of God, and I'm going to set aside that day, and I'm going to do it every single month as a special day that I consecrate to the Lord. You want to do that? That's fine. You certainly can. Are you going to condemn me because after worship on Sunday I like to watch the Cowboys? And I used to like to watch the Cowboys play football. Don't like to watch it quite as much anymore. They're so bad. But so do you judge me that I don't do what you do? Well, see, then you've crossed the line, because it's not required under the new covenant that day be set aside. If you want to esteem that day, that's fine, but don't require it of me. Because each of us do what we do to the Lord. And that's what's in the context, or the context of Romans 14. So I hope that helps. And you can see that difference as to what some were binding and thinking were a basis for their standing with God. And then in Romans 14, something that was optional and something that was individual in its nature. Okay? Yes, John?
I remember a lady that was a member of the church, as I said before, she was trying to impose on the other members, I guess it did become one of her personal boycotts of a certain restaurant that promoted homosexuality. Well, she refused to eat it. So the other members, they would eat it. So she got upset with that. And, I've been missing to her. Like, well, I got the same thing with a different kind of restaurant that you go through.
Yeah.
And I still love you, I'm not going to put you by name.
Yeah, and that's a good point.
Eventually, you can point out every single place you go to a shop, you wouldn't be able to buy anything.
Yeah.
Personal boycott, okay, that's fine. I'll say you could impose on somebody else.
That's exactly right. And what we need to keep in mind with regard to that, and this is a little bit of an aside with regard to our particular discussion, but nevertheless important to emphasize, that there is a limitation as to how far that goes, because we can't take Romans 14 to say so far as to say, well, if I can't engage in this sin, but it's all right for you to engage in that sin, because we're talking about things that are a matter of indifference to God, not things that are a matter of sin. What she was doing is saying, in her conscience, and with her conscience, she could not, in good conscience, go to that particular restaurant. To her, it would be sinful. And she perceives it to be sinful. So if it's sinful to her, it's sinful to everyone. And that's where the difficulty comes in with regard to those things, those matters. And why the Apostle Paul actually dealt with Romans 14. Or used Romans 14 to deal with it. Because in that chapter, what the Apostle Paul actually does is first teach and tell them both, there's nothing sinful, intrinsically sinful, about either of those things. Now, I could go to that woman and I could say, let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and let's talk about judging those who are in the world and judging those who are in the church, and let's make this distinction to where the Apostle Paul said, when I told you not to have fellowship with an individual who is an adulterer or a fornicator, I wasn't talking about those who are in the world, I was talking about those who are in the church. And a distinction is made in a statement that you would needs go out of the world. We are involved in those kinds of things. And it's not an endorsement of the politics or the morals of a restaurant that we buy a service from the restaurant. So I've got arguments that I can make to say that this is a matter of indifference toward God. If you can't in good conscience go to that restaurant, then don't. But you can't bind that on me. Why? Based upon Romans 14. Why? Because it's not inherently sinful for me to do that. So there is the limit that we place upon that. Sinful things don't apply, because if you're sinning by going somewhere, let's say that you say, well, I can good conscience go to a topless strip joint, you know, and eat my hot wings. Well, okay, we got a problem because that's sinful. That's inherently sinful. And it's not a matter just of, well, I can do it in good conscience. Well, you might can, but you're still sinning against God, because God is not accepting of that action. These actions in Romans 14, God was accepting of. So we've got to make that distinction. Problem is, and I've always understood this to be the case, perhaps you as well, in Romans chapter 14. The problem in Romans 14 weighs heavy upon the individual who cannot in good conscience engage in those activities. Because the reason why he can't in good conscience engage in those activities is because he thinks them to be sinful. Now, in Romans 14, Paul said, no, they're not sinful. But if you still have a pain of conscience, if you still have problems with it personally, then don't do it. But it's not sinful. And too often, individuals today, if you go to them about some particular thing they have a conscientious objection to, and you tell them that's not sinful, they aren't willing to accept that. It may be a lack of spiritual maturity. They are, after all, referred to in Romans 14:1 as those who are weak in the faith. So it might be maybe that they are immature in the sense that they are not knowledgeable. It may be, as I think the prejudice was in Romans 14, is that from where they came, as a part of their background, they had a hard time understanding. Even if intellectually they knew, you know, Paul said there's nothing wrong with it, but it still made them feel guilty because of their culture and practice. There may be that. But the problem is going to be differentiating. You don't, as far as determining whether one can have fellowship with another in a particular action or activity, you don't go to Romans 14 to determine that. You go to whatever passages apply to determine whether that is sinful or not. Once you've determined whether it's sinful or not, then you can go to Romans 14 for application. Because Romans 14 is very limited in the scope as to what it is referring to. But in this particular case, there is at least some way to where there are days that we can esteem as a matter of personal conscience and practice, as long as we do not bind them on others, and as long as we acknowledge and recognize that these things are not compelled, but rather they are a matter of option or authorized liberty, that are acceptable for us to do. So there are certain ways in which we can esteem days. That's why we need to be careful about that. If someone determines that they're going to set aside a particular day for a particular observance, and to be honest, I think we do that somewhat with Thanksgiving. I really think we do. We recognize that as an entirely secular holiday. And surely everybody knows that. You know, the Bible didn't establish Thanksgiving. It was a national holiday that was established. But it was established as a nation for the nation to take the time to express thanks to God for the blessings that we have as a nation. And we understand it has absolutely no bearing upon our salvation whether we observe that day of Thanksgiving or not, that it has absolutely nothing to do with what God requires of us. But if I decide, even on that day, whichever day it is in November each year, that I'm going to take the time to set aside, and I'm going to make it a day of prayer, and I'm going to make a special effort to offer thanks to God, personally and privately, for all the blessings that He's given me and that He's given our nation, I don't think that I'm doing anything wrong. If, however, we as a congregation, we had our Thanksgiving service where we incorporated those things as a practice of organized religion, organized faith, then that's will worship. There's a difference that we make and a distinction that we make in that regard. Okay? Yes?
You know, you talk about those things back in the 30s. I can remember when a member of the church wouldn't allow their kids to play cards on Sunday. Play a game where it had dice, and of course you couldn't buy anything hardly on Sunday except gasoline because they had the blue laws. I thought it was wrong to work, but they just passed that law so more people could be off to go to the church services.
Right.
But as time went along, as you see, I don't. I like I said, I don't. never was a big issue, but I just know that's the way my mother was brought up. All of her family was members of the church, and she just wouldn't let us do that on Sunday. Well, after we got a little bit older and everything, and I guess we got a little wiser, well, they forgot about all that stuff. She said, okay, do anything. But they said, well, Sunday is not, you don't worship the day Sunday. You know, it may be Sabbath was the day of rest, but Sunday is the day that you remember the death of Jesus Christ, and you go to worship services. And what you do in between the services, that's your business. That's just how the trends get sort of started and how they change.
Yeah. And again, it's kind of an indication as to where our society is. We came from, when you were young, a religious society to secular in many respects, but at least with regard to a spiritual or religious mindset in general, as a culture, as a people, to what was, I would say, in the 60s through the 90s, very much a secular culture, getting into the 2000s, where actually it's becoming antagonistic to faith. And so it's a real change with regard to where things are going. And again, we bemoan that, but at the same time, we recognize that in the first century, what they were experiencing as Christians in the first century is very much what we're experiencing now. And it may be our lot in life, but it shouldn't impact our standing with God. But yeah, it's a big change that happens. But we just need to acknowledge and recognize the difference between what we might do individually as an expression of personal devotion and what things are actually required by God. And I think the distinction that's made by Paul.
Even back in the 70s, the number of members of the church thought it was wrong to put up a Christmas tree.
Well, there's still some that feel that way.
Because it's a pagan thing. And like this, in my family, that they didn't do that. But, and they didn't give gifts on Christmas. They gave them on New Year's. You know, of course, that wasn't no religion. Except to it, but as time went on, decided, well, wrong in that. There's nothing wrong with it. Of course, you think about, you know, when my mother-in-law and I lived down in Kirkwood across from the Catholic Church, and on Christmas Eve, man, they went to Mass, and it lasted till midnight. You know, and then they left there, and they started their parties. Some of them started before they got there. The parking lot, the way it sounded next to where they live, but never could figure out if it was a religious holiday, what Santa Claus had to do with it. And Easter. Ridiculous Easter bunny. I mean, what's that? It's a religious holiday.
I think a lot of times when it's
bring those things in it.
Yeah, when men erect those things, it becomes somewhat confusing. Yes, sir.
Course, you read in Romans 14 about the weak brother, and about eating meats or when eating meat or whatever else. The brother is not weak because he doesn't think he should eat meat. He's weak because if you go someplace serving meat, his conscience is weak, and who can take of the meat and buy his conscience? It's not. I mean, like if I think it's wrong to eat meat, I can go to the house and not eat the meat, even though you are and you serve it. But some, they brought it up, well, like we see with Peter, you know, when the Gentiles came, he was weak in that sense. He wanted to, well, I'm sure the Jews should not be worse, you know.
I think that I might would differentiate just slightly with you in this regard, and let me explain. In 1 Corinthians 8, the apostle deals with the individual who may stumble as a result of the strong brother eating in his presence. So if I, who have a clear conscience with regard to eating meat, knowing that it's nothing to eat meat offered to an idol, and I do it in the presence of a brother who cannot conscientiously do it, there's that possibility that brother may, as a result of that, stumble or sin. In other words, he may be emboldened to do something that violates his conscience. And I should not do that. I should be deferential to my brother in that regard. So in that distinction, there is that possibility that some who cannot good conscience eat meat, some might would because of the temptation or enticement that I put before them, they might sin. I think in Romans 14, as well as 1 Corinthians 8, though, there are individuals who might would never be tempted or weakened in the sense of, I might just do it, who nevertheless can be defined as weak in faith in the sense that they have it wrong in them. In other words, they are unable to do something in good conscience that God has said is acceptable. And in that sense, they are weak. Even if they are never tempted to do it in the sense of, oh, it's hard for me to resist. They may be resolute in the fact that this I cannot do this and will not do it. But they nevertheless are identified as weak in Romans 14 because they are the individual who cannot practice what is an authorized liberty, what is something God allows. And I think that's the way, you know, a more technical definition. Now, concerning that individual who is weak and that he cannot do that, he is in danger if he is not resolute, in that if the enticement is placed before him, he may do something that violates his conscience. And as such, he may sin. You can be weak without the sin.
That's what I was trying to express. You did it a lot better.
Okay. All right. Well, I may have slightly misunderstood you there. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else? Wait a little bit. Kind of went off the subject a little bit. We always do whenever we get to Romans 14. But again, I wanted to acknowledge the fact that Romans 14 directly impacts our understanding of Galatians chapter 4. We've got to reconcile those two passages, and hopefully we've done it in such a way as to help you. There's one other passage I want to make note of so we can at least make a little bit more headway. I would like you to go to Romans, the 6th chapter, and keep your thumb on Galatians, now chapter 5 is where we'll be. But go to Romans chapter 6. And another difficult passage. In Galatians, the 5th chapter, and verse 1, we are told to stand fast in the liberty by which Christ has made us free, and do not be entangled again with the yoke of bondage. So you'll notice in that particular passage, we can have liberty, and we are made free, but we are referred to as bondservants or slaves of Christ. So the question is, how can we have liberty if we are slaves of Christ? And I thought that interesting because of the statement made in Galatians chapter 5 concerning we're made free in Christ, we are at liberty in Christ, where before we were in bondage, that is in slavery, but now we're no longer in slavery, and yet the Apostle Paul on numerous occasions describes the fact that we are bondservants of Jesus Christ, considered himself a doulos, or a bondservant of Jesus Christ. How do you correlate that? Being a bondservant with Christ is having liberty in Christ.
Well, he has these liberties from the old law, isn't
it? In Galatians 5, the specific reference again, the bondage of sin came under the law because there's no provision of mercy, so we're made free from sin. Well, the reason I thought to bring that up is because of the passage that is found in Romans chapter 6 and verses 16 through 18 and the description the Apostle Paul gives there concerning this concept of being enslaved to or in bondage to. Notice in verse 16, Romans 6. Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slaves whom you obey, whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness? So what the Apostle Paul is doing here is indicating is that, listen, you're going to be bound to somebody. And you have to make your decision as to whom you're going to be bound. You can be bound to sin, leading to death, or as indicated in this passage in Romans 16, or 6:16, of obedience leading to righteousness. But God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine which you were delivered, and having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. Slaves of sin, slaves of righteousness. And so I think that we can correlate that idea of being a slave or a servant of righteousness with being a servant of Jesus Christ. And the reason I bring that up is because the view that people have today that because we have liberty in Christ and are set free from the bondage of sin, that the idea there is that we are free from the constraint of law, that nothing is required of us. And the whole point that the Apostle Paul makes there in Galatians 5 and other places is that in order for you to be free from sin, you have to become a bondservant of Christ. In order to gain victory over sin, to be liberated from sin, you have to submit yourself to another master. You're going to be a bondservant of someone, or as indicated in Romans 6, something, either sin or righteousness. Where are you going to present yourself? To sin or to righteousness? But there is always that subjugation on our part, and the reference is to our will. So the idea is that if I submit myself wholly, it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me, I submit myself wholly to Christ, then as a consequence of being a bondservant of Christ, I am free from the consequence of sinful activity. And so my hope is attained. Reconciliation with God is mine. Heaven is in my grasp as a result of being a bondservant of Jesus Christ. However, if I become a bondservant of sin, I present myself as a slave to sin, then the end of that, the consequence of that, is death, which is rightly identified as more bondage. So you've got being a bondservant, so servitude, submission of will in both cases. But one as a consequence leads to bondage, the other as a consequence leads to liberty. And there's the distinction that is made. But you have to submit yourself to Christ in order to gain liberty in Him. All right, appreciate very much everyone's kind attention here. And we'll pick up next week discussing the fruit of the Spirit versus the lust of the flesh, as is indicated in Galatians 5:16 through 26.